Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Dad Bod, Portraits of Pop Culture Papas, by Kean Cruz, narrated by Kean Cruz. For my family. Prologue. What is a man? A miserable little pile of secrets. Dracula, Castlevania, Symphony of the Night, Prologue. On the evening of December 21st, 2018, I was standing in the stone cold of a polar vortex outside of my local rep cinema, The Review. I was with my brothers and sisters-in-law, but not my wife. She was almost a week overdue, and her family had come up to Toronto so that we could spend some time together for the holidays. This was the last movie I would see before my son was born. 4 days later, after 36 hours of labor, at 2:30 in the afternoon, on Christmas Day. We were waiting in line to see Die Hard. It is shocking, in retrospect, how appropriate it was that Die Hard was the last movie I saw before becoming a dad. Die Hard has been, for many, many years, my deeply avowed favorite film. I've seen Die Hard in theaters over 20 times. I've seen it on television, monitors, and airplanes, countless more. Each time I am in the presence of Bruce Willis's greatest contribution to the human condition, a rictus grin of pure, unadulterated entertainment is plastered on my face. When I was 12, my grandmother bought me the Die Hard trilogy on VHS. It came in a gunmetal gray box that weighed as much as my approaching adolescence. This movie shaped me in many weird ways. I developed a bizarre habit of always looking for hiding spots when I entered a new place. School, arena, friend's house, mall. Just in case terrorists, who weren't really terrorists, struck. So that I could be the one person not caught by them and could thus disrupt their nefarious plans. The fly in the ointment, the monkey in the wrench. During university, I studied film, which meant that I watched a lot of movies that were nothing like Die Hard. And yet, even my arthouse Iranian film professor made us watch Die Hard to analyze its script and pacing. This woman devoted an entire lecture to how bad she thought The Big Lebowski was. Just hated it. The films she made were weird, artisanal vlogs from a pre-YouTube time. Diarist entrails of a purely esoteric, artistic aristocracy. And yet, even she said that Die Hard was a Swiss watch of a film. Every structural element of the plot beat with perfect precision. Now, as I continue to study the craft of writing, and I look back on Die Hard, I find myself surprised by the weird layers it has, and what it can tell us about family, masculinity, and the action movie genre itself. We'll get to all that later, trust me. But none of that was on my mind on December 21st, 2018. I just wanted to watch my favorite movie with some new people and relieve a bit of the tension that came from waiting for my overdue baby to be born. 2 weeks later, my wife and I were on the couch binging the first two seasons of the Castlevania animated series on Netflix. Castlevania video games have been in my life even longer than Die Hard. My thumbs first blessed a Belmont's whip at the tender age of 7, at before school care, with a pack of kids huddled around an old CRT monitor, swapping the controller with each death. I was the only one who made it past stage 1. By the time I scraped my way to stage 3, basking in the glittering awe of my peers, and the opening chiptune organ smashes of Wicked Child, dodging flying Medusa heads and killer ravens, I was hooked. Everything about it, the over-the-top gothic style, the nonsensical action, the difficulty that rewarded memorization and dexterity, the magic flaming whip, the monsters, I was in 7-year-old heaven. This was exactly 2 years ago as I write this, 3 years as I edit it. My wife was propped up with pillows, recovering from the visceral ordeal of childbirth. She was akin to a warrior of old, resting after a duel with the forces of nature, Like Beowulf, she was filled with old-fashioned Germanic mirth after her brush with both the cosmic and the chthonic. She had brought new life from within her out into the world, our sun, our little god, a miracle emerging from the kiln of chaos. Knees up, legs apart, ice applied at regular intervals. On her laptop, Dracula was in an old-fashioned punch-out with his son Alucard. They had cast aside weapons and magic, allies and pretense, stripped down to the eternal power struggle between father and son, expressed in that most primal form of violence, the fist. We were riveted to our tiny screen as Dracula repeatedly slugged his dampier son through the thick stone walls of the Count's Gothic castle complex. Then Dracula punched Alucard through one last wall, into Alucard's childhood bedroom. And something amazing happened. The high-octane, excellently animated battle set piece dissolved into a broken monologue, and for 6 or 7 seconds, Castlevania transcended its genre, medium, and franchise history. Like, it's a series of video games about a clan of vampire hunters who train their entire lives on the off chance that Dracula is resurrected and that his magic castle emerges from the mist, spewing demons into the land. Then one of them goes to the castle and murders their way through the demons right into the throat of the castle and whips Dracula back to death. Yes, the family has a magic whip that passes down from generation to generation. It is the only thing that can subdue Dracula. Hamlet, this is not. Upon seeing his son's nursery, the superhuman rage bled out of Dracula's eyes. "My boy," Dracula says, taloned hands clutching his chest. "I'm killing my boy." Those two words messed us up. They were delivered with such authenticity and skill, I have to call out Graham McTavish's vocal cords. Magnificent pipes. Between shared tears, my wife and I looked over at our son, sleeping in his little motorized swing set. "We painted this room. We made these toys," Dracula continued, soliloquizing now to his dead wife. "It's our boy, your greatest gift to me, and I'm killing him." He paused. "I must already be dead." The Lord of Darkness mourning his lost child and, through it, his own lost humanity was a hot emotional knife neither of us was prepared for. We had signed up for a spot of adventure and undead slaying to get us through the afternoon, not inadvertent profundity. On the surface, Castlevania is about fighting werewolves and vampires with a magic whip. Just beneath that shape-shifting skin, it's a story about family. Broken families. Lost families. The families we make ourselves out of the ashes of our lives. And pain. Real pain wrapped up in fantasy and starfire. Then, back in the show, with excruciating deliberation, Alucard slides the wooden stake, a piece of his broken childhood bed no less, into his own father. The world-ending crisis is averted, because there's always a world-ending crisis, am I right? And the machine of plot grinds on, leaving in its wake this moment of absurd sublimity to two new parents, so exhausted that they will take wisdom in the shape of fangs and magic and monsters. Because when you have a kid, everything becomes profound. Everything they do. Everything you witness, everything your new family experiences, is the first time it has ever happened in the universe. And it comes with an emotional avalanche that hits even harder than Dracula's left hook. Between these two scenes, bookended by these two pillars of pop culture that loom large in the media mausoleum of my consciousness, my life changed forever. My entire identity changed in ways that will continue to unfold for the rest of my life. I became a father. There's a little human being that my wife and I are responsible for. We're responsible for his life, his upbringing, his safety, his worldview. He calls me daddy, and when I look into his eyes, I see the cosmos. Fun fact, my dad wanted to name me Cosmo Cruz. Everything is completely different now. My life is totally different. And yet, I'm still the exact same knucklehead. I still love Die Hard. I still think too much about Castlevania. I naively assumed that when I became a father, something would change within me to help me become a better person. But I'm still the same guy, only sleep deprived and overwhelmed by new emotions, and frequently in the presence of a little person who arrests my attention so utterly it's like the sun has crept into the room. Change, if it has happened, is subtle, or else I'm oblivious. There's an incredible paradox with many experiences of growth. I never feel further from change than when it is imminent. During that visit with her family, my wife was dead certain our son would never be born. Instead, he would continue to gestate within her massive stomach for eternity. She had been pregnant for so long, her entire body and spirit subsumed in the process, it became impossible to remember a time when she wasn't pregnant. Our whole world was pregnancy. How could that change? The unknown was inconceivable. And then it happened. Part 1. Foundations. By way of introduction, you must have a little patience. I've undertaken, you see, to write not only my life, but my opinions also, hoping and expecting that your knowledge of my character and what kind of a mortal I am, by the one, would give you a better relish of the other. As you proceed further with me, the slight acquaintance which is now beginning betwixt us will grow into familiarity, and that, unless one of us is at fault, will terminate in friendship. Therefore, my dear friend and companion, if I should seem now and then to trifle upon the road, or should sometimes put on a fool's cap with a bell to it for a moment or two as we pass along, don't fly off, but rather courteously give me credit for a little more wisdom than appears on my outside, and as we jog on, either laugh with me, or at me, or in short, do anything, only keep your temper. Lawrence Stern, The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy, Gentlemen. Although I straight up stole this epigraph from Dave Hickey's excellent essay collection, Air Guitar. I have the hardest time writing about myself. Generally speaking, the nonfiction I write is about film, television, and video games. In these essays, I bury and obfuscate myself in Good Time Charlie-style analysis. I see my role as somewhat like a teppanyaki chef, slicing and dicing interesting bits and pieces, then flipping them into your mouth in the tastiest order. I am not the focus. Something else is. At most, I'm an interesting lens through which you, the listener, can experience a cool perspective on some new ideas. A good lens is invisible and shouldn't bring too much attention to itself, even as it inevitably warps the subject of consideration. Otherwise, it's a bit like a scalpel trying to cut itself. If I analyze and describe my own experiences too directly, I become an Ouroboros of intestinal articulation. The feedback loop of self dissecting self results in a thick layer of snowy noise. That's why I'm starting with Die Hard and Castlevania, with quotes from Tristram Shandy. That's a big part of the reason why I'm going to try to talk about what it is like for me to become a father, that shift of identity and the deepest understanding of one's role in the world through the locus of a bunch of goofy shows and games. It helps me hide, so that I can say something real. But it also helps me find a touchstone, a point of departure that we might share. By the same token, these cultural products matter a great deal to me. I'm invested in these works of mass media entertainment fiction to a dubious degree. Even if I'm not explicitly aiming my lens of analysis at myself, I am on the line here. I care about stories way, way too much. So even though this is an oblique entranceway, I'm still opening the door and trying to welcome you into my weird, labyrinthine heart, which is also a mystery to me. Were I to attempt a direct and explicit articulation, it would be a lie. For better or worse, my sense of self is informed by these many pieces of art that I spend the majority of my waking life contemplating. In a way, diving deep into these texts is getting to know me a heck of a lot better than any narrative biographical detail. That doesn't mean I'll be entirely absent, some detached voice claiming ethereal authority. Like I said, I'm in this. I'm a new dad, after all. My hope, to understand what it means to become a father in our day and age, what it means to me, and what it means to others, is a wholly internally driven enterprise. Which brings us to the dad bod. It's high time I start to unpack that one. The term initially popped up in 2015 as an example of the curious media sphere we currently live in. Mackenzie Pearson, a student at the time, coined the term in her college newspaper, claiming that a guy who was less than ripped was actually more attractive. Pearson provided a tight psychological argument. A guy with a dad bod is sort of in shape, but doesn't take it too seriously. That means a guy with a dad bod is less self-obsessed. He therefore has good priorities, and being with a guy with a dad bod doesn't make a woman feel bad about her own body, given society's ever-crushing mandate to make women undermine their self-worth at every opportunity. Always starved for content, newspapers of record, magazines, websites, blogs, Twitterers, YouTubers, and late-night talk show hosts glommed onto this new term and ran with it until it entered our cultural lexicon. Then, 5 years later, science caught up with a sophomore's intuitions. Researchers found that women associated the dad bod with all kinds of incredible parenting behaviors, like babies melt this person's heart, or this person tries to teach their children new things, from their physique alone, with no faces even. And they rated the toned gym bod the absolute dog's breakfast. They thought cut men were trash. If they wanted a fling, sure, they'd go for some jacked torpedo. But when it came to making a real life together, the dad bod won out. I should of course mention that the dad bod male body used in the study is better understood as Hollywood casual dad bod, as opposed to the bodies of actual real people. Think John Hamm in Mad Men, not Seth Rogen in anything. This is where things get interesting. The fact that these researchers could so easily populate a study with the exact same psychological assertions found in a college newspaper's initial hot take indicates that there's something going on here. It seems like folks really are making these deep associations based on the image and perception of male physique. Of course, it's hogwash. But it's very interesting hogwash. Our illusions tell us as much, or perhaps even more, about us as our truths. The dad bod is an acceptance that images, and particularly media-driven images of fatherhood, are essential to our knee-jerk apparatus for navigating the world. When push comes to shove and we are bombarded with imagery all the dang day long, we will fall back upon the associations and patterns that Occam's razor provides, regardless of how well they stand up to sober scrutiny. This association is also an acceptance, within that image, and only to a certain extent, of softness within the definition of mass marketable masculinity. Specifically, the softening that accompanies placing other people's needs before your own. That softening might not be a bad thing, despite dude's initial reluctance to accept it. I know it's been hard for me. I was never cut, But I was in shape. I ran, and I did rock climbing. I was lithe. Now I'm not. And even though I have a very hard time with the way my body has changed post-fatherhood, my wife finds the thickness alluring. Constant attention upon the self is unsustainable. If you temper steel repeatedly, it becomes brittle. If you question and re-question your motivations, you become an anxious, paralyzed mess. If you focus on yourself to the exclusion of others, you become a narcissistic monster. This sounds a lot like a recipe for toxic masculinity. So maybe softness is great. Let's be honest, masculinity needs all kinds of help, especially when it comes to identity and definition in some way, shape, or form that isn't exclusionary or bigoted. A centuries-long Spartan obsession with hardness and toughness and pseudo-military ethos in entirely inappropriate circumstances, combined with an utter disregard for emotional intelligence and sensitivity, has not served men well. Softness can undo that, or at least provide the beginnings for approaching a different way of being a man. Not that this is the first time someone's tried to redefine masculinity, nor is this the only avenue for change. Hardly. It's one potentially interesting crack in the brittle armor of old man tough guy. Lastly, this peculiar bundle of associations illustrates the dynamic exchange between culture and self, as art imitates life, imitating art that's playing at life while watching art between episodes of Living Life. I see culture as a soup, and we're swimming in it. No, it's not a mixed metaphor. Unless you're some kind of hermit, you are inundated with carefully curated images day in and day out, both carefully curated by you for self-selected need and interest, but also carefully curated by whomever is trying to make a buck off your attention. Fatherhood, as a cultural concept, is one such current in the broader bowl of masculinity, which is, itself, balanced on an island of mushy crackers called identity. And though these elements are ever in flux, a relational web between all the things we see and hear, all the art we imbibe, and all the conversations we have, nestles in our mind like worms. Among all that froth and bother, relatively coherent nets of meaning float to the surface and keep bobbing up and down in our psyche, no matter how many times we push them back down into the broth. What I'm saying is, every single dad that I've ever seen on a TV show or movie helped inform my idea of fatherhood. Those images are burned indelibly into my mind's retina, albeit vaguely, whether I want them or not. They inhabit a similar space as my friends' dads growing up. They did not raise me. I have but a broken picture of them both, but I have a total feel for their vibe. It is key to discuss the vague, flabby shape that these dad bods have as cultural figures, or chunks of gristle in our cultural soup. What presence they exert independent of the text, the constellation of associations that these figures exert in shorthand. We know these dads. By the very fact of their cultural presence, they exist like mindworms haunting the souls of all the people that you know. In the same way, grandparents who are like, "You never gave your daughter Barbies, and now she's totally into Barbies. See, gender's real." They're not being very good detectives. Poirot would be ashamed of this premature deduction. That daughter just came in contact with the culture mindworm that's infected every other child in her school, a hive as large and wide as the entire media ecosystem, sowing its spores wherever screens emit their liquid crystal dreams. So, to take the temperature of these mindworms, I want to write as descriptive a subjective analysis as I can to try and capture one data point. How do these dad figures seem to me, glimmering and warbling in the distorted breeze of my nostalgia and caffeine-soaked brain? What is the gist that they give off, such that we would tap into an informal conversation with a coworker or lesser-known acquaintance when we don't have access to the fact-checking apparatus of the internet. Because it is this gyre of accreted half-truths that makes up our gut take on so many things. Our fundamental understanding of fatherhood is no different. Like I said earlier, this swirling panoply of figures of fatherhood, these dad bods, act in a similar way as the fathers of my friends growing up. I very much don't have the experience of being raised by them, even though I've witnessed examples of their style of fathering. I witness their spirit, and that tells us so much about what it means to be a father. Until we have the Matrix and can download an entire life of experiences into our noodle, the closest thing that we have are the distilled extrapolations rendered in the process of creating popular fiction. In part, this is because there is no guidebook for being you as a parent. You are you. Your kid is your kid. There are too many granular variables. And yet, that vibe speaks volumes. You see it between the moments of action, in the gestalt of being a dad. That's what we're looking at here. And we're going to have to peer deep and in between sunbursts of gross incandescence to find that midnight sun from which our shadowy image of fatherhood spawns. I'm not here to critique art. Not really. But rather, to dissect the dads portrayed within and describe what it unveils to me as a person trying to figure out what it means to be a dad. To be me as a dad in the present moment. By comparing these archetypes and examples that permeate our culture. Another way of putting it is to ask, what story has the media been trying to tell me about fatherhood? As I noted before, this isn't something that I have any choice in. We all swim in our culture's soup. We don't get to choose what orthodox is. All we can do is try to see it. And figure out if that's how we want to live. That requires distance and curiosity. So my process is one of distanciation, an attempt to look at the tropes and archetypes inside me as though I'm an outsider, which requires absorbing as many alternative perspectives as possible via these works of art, and using them like a crowbar to lever my assumptions and, hopefully, reveal what's beneath them. I have to try to break it down like an alien would, unaware of the connections that seem obvious to us, or like an intellectual yokel asking honestly dumb questions to see where it takes us, all the while balancing the dual mind, the alien and the insider, the critic and the memoirist, because, well, otherwise it'd be gibberish. Bear in mind, this thing is written after being drunk on sleep deprivation for 2 years. Take these pieces of text not as writing per se, so much as howls that have echoed their way from the depths of my soul, either because the scream with the most clarity or the most imminence or because I'm sleepwalking. So I'm balancing as best I can, seeing from both perspectives simultaneously to attempt to manifest a binocular vision. Take two relatively two-dimensional pictures of what it means to be slash become a father, and by arranging a composite of both, render a new three-dimensional image. Undoubtedly, I will slip every now and again, falling off one side or the other on this balance beam. It's those moments of awkwardness when I ask for a bit of forbearance. I'm going to try to keep the momentum up so that when I slip off the tightrope, it won't be for too long, and by reaching one arm up over the other side, I can hopefully flip back up and keep the whole edifice hopping, skipping, and jumping along. Or I'll fall flat on my face, and at least we can share a laugh. 404. Dad Not Found. Every dad starts with a pregnant lady. Twice. Hell, every person starts with a pregnant lady, at least until we can rig up those birthing pods. After my wife gave birth, I wandered around the city in a permanent haze of wonder, in part because of sleep deprivation, but in part because...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?